We'll call him up. We'll go on to the next bill. Okay, 117, is not ready to go yet, so we'll go to one, let's see. We don't have Senator Donnelly either.
26 was that.
What?
26.
Well, if we're not going to be able to get people to come back, maybe we'll just wait to go on to the operating budget.
You mean, bill people?
Yeah. Apparently my staff told people that we were not going to get back to bills. That was in error, but if we're not going to get back to bills because we haven't got the people to testify on them, we'll just have to wait till tomorrow to go on to bills. So Senator Frank, whenever you're ready, we will recess to wait for the operating budget.
We said we'd start at 5:30. We'll recess to 5:30 then.
Okay.
Okay, you're set on university.
We lost our bills for now. We'll take them up tomorrow.
Are you ready to go on public safety?
Yeah. The only thing we haven't done is DOT. Steve?
Will the Finance Committee please come to order? Present are Senator Rieger, Senator Phillips, Senator Donnelly, Senator Sharp, and myself. The first bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 117, the Independent Living Council, and we have Stan Ridgway to testify from Voc Rehab.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Stan Ridgway. I'm Deputy Director of Vocational Rehabilitation. Senate Bill 117, the establishment of a statewide independent living council, was introduced by Senator Halford at the request of the department. In order for Alaska to continue receiving federal funds for independent living services, the state must establish in statute a statewide independent living council. At the present time, the state receives approximately $900,000 in federal money, along with $602,000 in state money, for a total of about $1.5 million that's used to fund independent living centers throughout the state. As part of the Rehabilitation Act of 1992, there was a requirement that a statewide independent living council be appointed by the governor, and in order to receive those funds, the independent living council and the Division of Voc Rehab had to jointly develop a state plan for independent living services. That was done in 1993 when Governor Hickel appointed the first council in October of 1993. Because it was a federal law, there was an assumption that it would not need to be in state statute. However, that was challenged later that year, and in 1994, Governor Hickel reappointed the council, and it's our understanding now that we need to have this established in statute by the end of this legislative session in order for the independent living council to operate.
Senator Phillips?
Access Alaska in Anchorage.
Questions by members of the committee? There is a $142,000 fiscal note. That is, I believe, all federal funds with the exception of a very small general fund match.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
If there aren't any questions, this one's pretty straightforward. Could we have a motion to move the bill with the accompanying fiscal note? Senator Sharp?
Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill number 117-S with accompanying fiscal note.
Are there objections? Without objections, Senate Bill 117 will be moved out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. Thank you very much. That brings us to Senate Bill 64. And I need the sign-up sheet if we have one back in one back there on 64. This is Transportation CS. Senator Rieger.
Mr. Chairman,
I think a number of you are familiar with the bill, so I'll be brief in my comments. But Senate Bill 64 is a step towards the privatization of the Alaska Railroad. And basically what this bill does is reshape the corporation into a form which is the ownership of which is represented by shares of stock, so that the transfer to private ownership could be more easily accomplished, either through the sale of the entire corporation or through the sale of individual shares or appropriation of individual shares of stock. So this bill directs the railroad to form a successor corporation represented by shares of stock. There is I think the ultimate desire that I had in favoring this legislation is sitting through the hours of testimony in Senate Finance and before that in House Finance over the years, in which we have, in effect, been a second board of directors of the Alaska Railroad and have put restrictions on the composition of the board, the business decisions that they make, and we've in effect restricted their activity and paralyzed them to the extent that they're not coming close to maximizing the potential of the railroad, and I think it's actually a detriment to economic development in the state. So that's, in a nutshell, what this bill does is set the ball rolling towards privatization. This Division of State Libraries contacted us after the bill moved out of transportation, or the Alaska State Library, rather, asking if we could help them in their efforts to secure the historical records that the railroad has. And we've come up with an amendment which would transfer the historical records of the Alaska Railroad to the State Library, except those records which the railroad appropriately should keep in their own archives because they're still necessary for legal reasons in the operation of the railroad. The railroad has seen that amendment and has come back with a suggested change to the amendment. The only change that they are recommending technically is that, as we say, the records which are needed by the successor corporation, their amendment would say any successor corporation, so that the records stay with the corporation as long as they're needed, or any successor corporation, as long as they're needed for operation. And once they are not needed and are truly solely of historical interest, they're transferred to the State Library. That amendment is behind the position paper from the Alaska Railroad Corporation. And I have no problem with that. I think that's actually more technically correct. So what I would do is amend. I'd like to move amendment number one.
Amendment number one has been moved as corrected, deleting the line 18, change the D to any. Is that the only difference?
Up above it, where it says successor corporation for its use or the use of any successor to that corporation.
In both places, it changes Z to any. Is that the...
It's in writing. In writing.
Do you want to move this language?
I would like to move this as amendment.
Okay, move this language as amendment number one instead of the other draft language. Okay, there's a motion to adopt amendment number one by Senator Rieger dealing with the archives and the records. Is there objection?
Yes.
Without objection, amendment number one is adopted. We do have somebody from archives here. Do you want to testify on this amendment, or does this take care of the problem? Okay, thank you. Senator Phillips?
There's a position paper from the railroad, marked 41095, which is 2 days ago. What is the position on the bill?
They don't have a formal position, Mr. Chairman. The bill, as originally introduced, had a couple of points which the railroad was concerned about, and we attempted to address those. One was the requirement for an appraisal, which was deleted in the transportation CS. The other was some more refined language referring to the composition of the board of directors. One of the things that the railroad offered for the legislature's consideration was an idea of putting the shares into a trust to be administered by a trustee rather than voted by the governor as the owner of the shares. And what this bill is crafted to allow the legislature to appropriate the shares to a trust subsequently if we decide that that's a good idea, but there just wasn't enough detail provided of how it would work for us to incorporate that into the transportation CS. So I think it's a good idea, but it might take some fairly considerable work and wouldn't want to hold up the process while we investigate.
Senator Rieger, I have kind of two thoughts on the railroad, and they go opposite directions. One is anything we can do to get it toward the private sector, I support. But as long as it's in the public sector, we've got kind of an oxymoron of a private corporation wholly owned by the state, and we don't have very much control over it. And I'm not interested in expanding their powers other than toward, or their independence, other than toward privatization. And I just wonder if you could comment on that in terms of what the bill does.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this by itself would be only acceptable as an interim measure. The legislature is going to have to appropriate the shares subsequently or force the sale of the shares to consummate the transaction. The only thing that you gain by doing the transfer this way is avoiding a mandated distress sale, which is the other alternative that's been offered from time to time and just says you shall sell the railroad and put it out to bid and take the highest bidder. And there's question about how much the railroad could be sold for under that process as opposed to this, but I think this will help ensure that we get the maximum value for the proceeds when it's sold.
But does this legislation in any way weaken our ability to interact with the railroad on issues from the moose they're doing away with on the route or the way they handle their roadbed or what happens to their property or who gets to utilize it, how they handle lease problems, what they do in competition with the private sector, and so forth?
It does. It does reduce that ability.
If it were going toward a private sale I thought was really going to happen, I would be willing to go along with that, but I'm not. That's why I say the concerns I have are somewhat schizophrenic in that I want them to be, as long as they're in state ownership, responsible or not in state ownership. And it seems that we don't have the best of both of those worlds now.
We certainly don't. I mean, it's...
Senator Frank?
I'll defer to Senator Sharp.
Senator Sharp?
Two items. On page 3, at line 24, it says a governor or legislature by appropriation. With one or the other being able to do it, isn't that an opportunity for confusion?
Where are you?
Line 3, page 3, line 24, little b.
Actually, this was a one of the amendments or the final cleanups that we put in the bill to ensure that we had the continued ability to dispose of the railroad by appropriation. The earlier drafts showed that the governor may dispose of shares when he determines it's in the state's best interest. This made it very clear that we could do it also.
But does this prohibit the governor doing it independently or the legislature doing it independently? I mean, doesn't it allow one or the other? Or
yes.
Because of
It does allow one or the other.
No. Yeah. The other question I have is on the Division of Legal Services sheet here on the first page, last paragraph. It's hard for me to understand how this is legally a truism, because it says, though the successor corporation is not a public corporation, the state as shareholder will be liable for any liabilities of the corporation exceed the value of its assets of such, if such situation should ever occur, while the state still owns the shares. Any other corporation that is not a state-owned or is a public or a private corporation, is a shareholder is only liable for the value of their shares, not for the liabilities that go beyond the assets of the corporation. And I wonder, since this is going to be a taxable corporation and everything else, why is that hook in there? Is that something that George, or who did this? George Rumo feels is mandatory?
Senator Eager.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in the bill which says that that is the case. I think what George Udermull is doing is pointing out that when you have a fairly substantial shareholding interest in a corporation, sometimes the liability does extend to the shareholder. I'm not sure of that, but that's how I interpreted that when I read it.
Sometimes they're able to pierce the corporate veil, right? Yeah. Somehow I imagine they would be able to in our case.
Okay, so basically it's a sole proprietorship under the corporation shield. One owner owns a whole.
Yeah.
Okay.
One last thing, Mr. Chair. In the operating budget or capital budget, you want to appropriate these shares anywhere after the effective date of this, that would be fine with me.
But we're allowing the governor to appropriate them without further legislative action.
Sell them. Not appropriate. No, this doesn't say that the governor can appropriate them. It says the governor can sell them.
Senator Rieger, your simple bills.
Yeah,
Senator Phillips.
On the same line, page 3, line 24, actually 25, is there a definition of best interest of the state? Is there a criteria or standard or a judgment call whether it's the best interest of the state? Either through the view of the legislature or view of the government on that?
That's my knowledge.
Okay, I just didn't want to make it. I know this is a tough issue to. Can't put you on the spot, but I think maybe we should have some kind of standard describing what's the best interest of the state.
Do we have anyone? Let's see. We don't have Mark Hickey is signed up to answer questions, I assume, but not to testify. This is not one that I think we're going to be able to move quickly or easily, so I would like to kind of hold it and go on to the next
on our list. That's fine.
We'll hold Senate Bill 64 and go to Senate Bill 26.
26.
And we'll be at ease briefly because the sponsor is still discussing something. We're at ease. We're going to take up Senate Bill 26. Holding 64. Do we still have this?
No, I agree with you. I just
okay. Online.
Let me see. I don't have any personal interest.
Donnelly on Senate Bill 26. We are back to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 26 would waive juveniles over the age of 14 who commit a second crime utilizing a firearm to adult court. It has the support of police associations, the National Rifle Association, and the organization representing the public safety employees of the state. The problem now is juveniles, there's no mandatory waiver of juveniles, even though I think that we ought to send a message that utilization of a firearm in the commission of a crime is a very, very serious offense. And I do think this is an area that justifies mandatory waiver to adult court. Once again, it would only be for second offenders. It wouldn't be for a first offense. It would only be if they had committed a prior offense utilizing a firearm. And I think we should send a message, especially to young people, that abuse of firearms is society's going to take that very seriously, and should hold them accountable for it. This is really brought to my attention by educators in my community who said that after passage of the laws that forbidden firearms from being brought to our schools, the police felt very frustrated because when they did apprehend juveniles who brought firearms to school, it didn't seem like anything ever happened to them, and the police never found out what would occur again, and sometimes the student would just show up in school again. We have made some progress with that, with the school districts, as far as enforcing that through suspensions more strongly. But I think a message in state law would be very beneficial, both to law enforcement, as exhibited by the letters of support in the file from law enforcement community. And they were willing to be here to testify, but as you know, the schedule's been so hectic the last couple of days that we don't have them lined up to testify this morning, but they have been available in prior opportunities to testify in support of the legislation.
Question, Senator Donnelly, did you consider this? I would personally be interested in offering an amendment who use firearms or deadly weapons if we have a definition in the criminal statute that would work with that. I don't want to unnecessarily complicate it, but I believe that there are cases where the weapon of choice didn't happen to be a firearm, but it was obviously with the same intended result.
Mr. Chairman, I would support that because we do have a definition of deadly weapons in the statutes. We do have a definition of deadly versus defensive weapons, and that would sound like a pretty reasonable step. It would certainly make the bill go further than originally intended, but I personally wouldn't object to it.
Does the term criminal offenses exclude minor misdemeanors?
No. It would include assaults that were misdemeanors and other utilization of firearms in the commission of a crime that were misdemeanors. Those are still criminal offenses.
Okay, this is, so it would apply to
misdemeanors and felonies.
14 years of age and older. I think I would have the same concern about other deadly weapons than if.
I think it's a good step the way it is. I think it'd be a little less controversial the way it is. Firearms certainly are a very serious danger, and in the hands of minors, we've seen more and more of this in the past, and certainly something I think that we need to send a message is going to be treated seriously. And I think this type of a format gives the opportunity for the judge or the people who handle the initial offense, whether it's, if it's diverted into the social service system, to give a very strong warning to the minor that, okay, you got away with it this time and you're not going to get that serious repercussions, but next time you're going to be treated as an adult. So.
Senator Rieger?
Just one question. When you're treated as an adult under these sections, do all of the other laws which specify the penalties for being a minor, that it would apply if you're a minor, get lifted, or only some of the penalties? Or is this waiver into adult court, meaning that for every intent and purposes, you're treated as if you were 21 years old or not?
Yes.
So,
except that if you were incarcerated as a result, the incarceration, there's different rules.
I'm wondering about
they're a segregated population. They're not thrown in with adults in any kind of correctional institute.
I'm just wondering, the bill that went through here a couple weeks ago where you lose your driver's license, does that still apply, or is that now, that applied to juveniles 16 to 20, 16 to 20. So do you get treated as an adult plus lose your driver's license, or do you just get treated as an adult?
Oh, do you mean the bill that came through that said if you committed a crime, you'd lose your driver's license also?
Yeah.
Well, you would lose your driver. Yeah, you would be treated as an adult, but you'd also use your driver's license.
So the juvenile penalty plus the adult penalty would apply?
Yeah, because I think that wasn't based on whether they were in juvenile court or adult court. It was based on whether or not they committed the offense. Mm-hmm. And they were within a certain age.
Senator Phillips?
Senator Collins, you may not have the answer to this question, and I don't think you do, but we have a letter here that says there are more than just firearms, but knives. It says that knives are a weapon of choice for many juvenile criminals. It says their overall firearms are used in only 30% of violent crime. Just in the juvenile, 80% of weapon of choice is a predominant firearm.
No, I would assume that it's probably predominantly other types, but I don't have any particular numbers for that. I guess the question is, firearms are clearly have the potential to be the most deadly of the types of weapons that juveniles could be utilizing. And just to make a real clear statement that to send a message, because so much of what goes on in juvenile crime is what we hear, that juveniles say, well, you know, nobody told me to stop, really. I mean, there was no serious deterrent to it. And so I just kept going until I became an adult, and then all of a sudden I ended up in prison. And this gives the opportunity for somebody who does abuse firearms to get a real clear message. You do it again, it's going to be treated very, very seriously. And so now's the time to stop.
We have, three people signed up to testify. Who do we have from Health and Social Services?
Chairman Helford, I'm Kathy Tibbles with the Division of Family and Youth Services, Department of Health and Social Services. The department is opposed to this bill because of the lowering of the age to 14 and because of the broadening of the type of offenses. We are concerned that a juvenile could be adjudicated for perhaps a misdemeanor offense with use of a firearm shooting a stop sign or something similar to that, and then if involved in a more serious offense, be automatically waived to adult jails, because at this point an automatic waiver to adult court means a waiver to adult prisons, not back to the juvenile system. And we just believe that most 14-year-olds still have an opportunity to be amenable to treatment and would prefer to continue with the current statute that allows for a waiver to adult court for particularly heinous crimes rather than to mandate an automatic waiver on all 14-year-olds for this broad category of offense.
Senator Phillips?
You say the department, I'm assuming.
That is my understanding. I am just here representing the department.
I want to figure out where the executive branch is coming. So the governor is opposed to this.
That is my understanding, Senator.
Would the governor be opposed to the bill if it dealt with felony offenses instead of felony and misdemeanor offenses?
Senator Halford, I can't answer that question. I don't think the opposition would be as strong, but I'd have to refer that question.
What about the question of if the language said offense against a person? And I'm not nearly as affronted by the assault on a parking meter or a stop sign as I am on even the misdemeanor assault on a person.
Yes, Chairman Halford, I assume that the opposition would not be the same, but I would have to defer that question. I can't answer that.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Donnelly, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out that this argument that the minor would go to adult prison presumes that the second offense the minor commits is somehow subject to mandatory sentencing. I mean, it'd have to be a very, very serious offense to mandate that the minor go to prison if convicted. It'd probably be the kind of endangerment of society we might want them in some sort of protective incarceration. Because most of the kinds of crimes that would fall under this, there's no mandatory sentence for, so the judge could examine the situation of the particular defendant and feel that if incarceration wasn't necessary, they wouldn't have to order it.
Further questions? Thank you. We have Willie Anderson of NEA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. NEA supports this legislation because of the crime that is existing in our public schools. Public school employees and public school students are getting increasingly harmed by firearms in the schools, and we want to deter that at any cost that we can, because we are losing lives of school employees and children in our public schools. If this bill, and based on what I've been able to read and listen to responses, comments on it, this would deter the use of firearms in the public schools, and we at NEA supports this legislation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions by members of the committee? Senator Phillips?
Well, if you can send that message to the governor, then we'll
help. We have Margo Knuth signed up to testify, but I don't see her back there. I did have a question I would like to ask the Department of Law with regard to the potential of an amendment or deadly weapon, because I want to make sure that it works, but I think that it does, and I think it's a step in the right direction.
There's a definition in the statutes that distinguishes between defensive weapons and deadly weapons.
Mm-hmm. I was asking what was the definition of a deadly weapon. That's my question.
Yeah, and that's a very good question. If we're considering the amendment, I think Margot could have told us that right offhand. Would you please?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my only worry is that the administration is already very reluctant and opposed to the legislation, and I think the best case can be made for firearms, although I do feel that the use of deadly weapons is a very serious offense also.
Yeah, I don't want to subject the bill to a veto because we tried to make the perfect the enemy of the possible. I mean, I'd like to get as far as we can in this area and still get the law to actually take effect. But I do agree with the comment that apparently the most common weapon used by juveniles is not a firearm, and therefore we're not solving the largest portion of the problem. And if deadly weapon is a specific enough definition, then I think it should be considered. Why don't we stand at ease and see if we can see where the Department of Law is, and we'll get a copy of the statute. Senator Phillips, you have a question before we stand at ease?
That's why I was asking Senator Thomas questions about statistics that I didn't expect to have. Yeah. I'd like to see the reform at least pass the legislation and get have the governor's approval. I have a saying, too, don't let the perfect ruin the good as well.
So. Yeah. Senator Donnelly, do you have the definition of...
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff did identify the definition of a deadly weapon. It's in Title 11. 81.900, paragraph 13, deadly weapon means any firearm or anything designed for and capable of causing death or serious physical injury, including a knife, an axe, a club, metal knuckles, or an explosive. It's a pretty all-encompassing. I guess there's a specific definition of defensive weapons also. If I can find it.
I think if we're trying to reach a compromise that actually becomes law over the administration's objections, if we add or deadly weapon, we may want to look at applying it to felony convictions versus any convictions or something else. To make sure that we have, that we don't have an application we're not trying to reach somehow. Would you, could staff make a copy of that, and we'll stand at ease and see if we can get the Department of Law. Continuing on Senate Bill 26, we do have... two people on teleconference, I believe. We have Victor Gunn in Fairbanks and Janie Weniger in Palmer. Janie, are you on? Is the teleconference system working?
This is Victor Gunn, I can hear you.
Victor, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, and then we'll go to Janie when we get the Palmer hookup working.
This is Deputy Chief of Police Victor Gunn in Fairbanks with the Department of Public Safety, and I've read the bill, have it in front of me. The Department of Public Safety would support the bill. I've listened to the testimony that I've heard so far this morning, and I find it interesting that if the addition of deadly weapon is added to the bill, I think it would make it a more encompassing deterrent to some of the crimes that we see, rather than just focusing on firearms. There's pretty much a strong message that firearms are not acceptable in Fairbanks schools, and that there are penalties attached to that, both through ordinances, statutes, and federal law. That message is pretty well circulated, and we still have occasions when students choose to disobey the law. This message would make it much much stronger. I also think that the addition of or limiting it to felonies may make the whole thing more palatable to everybody, but that's a personal opinion. So I suppose what I'm saying is, from what I've heard this morning, I think that adding a deadly weapon as an amendment would be, I would be in favor of that from a law enforcement perspective.
Thank you. I think the sponsor would favor that. I would favor that, but we are trying to figure out how far we can actually get and have the bill become law. I think the consideration might be that if we expanded the definition to deadly weapon, we would probably have to contract the application to felonies or something thereabouts. So that might be a compromise that was suitable.
One way to look at that is there are already penalties attached to the mere possession of, and an assault not involving deadly force, but the threatened use of deadly force with a firearm or one of these weapons. There are deterrents in that realm. I think what message we're looking at is trying to send an overall message of deterrence to our youth. I think this would be a very strong message. I'm in favor of it. I think that by applying it to felonies, it would take away some of the sting that I've heard so far this morning, and I think I would be in favor of that personally. The addition of deadly weapons and limiting everything to felonies would be very palatable to our department.
Another thought for consideration is that I think there is language in several statutes that could apply it. Instead of applying it to felonies only, it could be applied to crimes against a person, which would eliminate some misdemeanors, but not all misdemeanors, such as the highest class of misdemeanor assault.
That is correct, the way I understand it.
Senator Phillips, do you have a question?
I have a question for you. This is Randy Phillips. You heard the testimony from the department, and it sounds like the bill as written, may get a veto. And by adding deadly weapons, I mean, I understand what you're doing and at least support it conceptually, but you do understand the situation here, do you not?
I understand the political situation, yes, sir.
Okay. Well, maybe we can have some help from you guys, too, as well as NEA.
When you get down to it, the assault in a fourth degree misdemeanor, if a firearm or a deadly weapon is used to commit an assault, you've automatically got an assault in the third degree if they caused fear of imminent serious physical injury, which is a C felony. If they caused physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, that's a C felony. So I think you're not going to be too restrictive if you say that you limit this to felonies.
Further questions by members of the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. And you are the Department of Public Safety for the City of Fairbanks?
That's correct. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police, representing the City of Fairbanks Department of Public Safety.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Do we have Janie Winiger on yet? She She is apparently not on. Do we have the Palmer teleconference site, or what is the situation? You're in the process of trying to call back to the Palmer site? Okay, if there's any way you can call that site directly, try that too, so that they're trying and you're trying. Senator Sharp?
Talking to, through the chair to my lawyer friend, what does reckless endangerment, even though it doesn't cause physical harm, is reckless endangerment of a person with a firearm, is that, or a deadly weapon, would that be a felony? Or do you have to inflict some kind of harm before it's a felony?
I'm not exactly sure. I have to double check the criminal statutes. I thought that the most serious forms of assault, reckless and, well, intentional assaults, might be up in the lower felony categories, you know.
But I'd hate to restrict it. I'd hate to restrict it to a point that they actually had to do physical injury to a person with a deadly weapon before you, you know, this would apply, I think.
Yeah.
Just endangerment and threat.
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to remember, this is not applying a penalty. This is just saying that they're tried as adults. You know, yep. We are not applying a penalty until someone is found guilty, and then, and only then, do the penalties that attach to adults go forward. So we need to keep that in mind as we consider it.
And the judge will still be making up the decision.
That's right. And the judges, I would expect, are going to have an awful lot of concern for younger defendants.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if the, what the committee wanted to do was move to the format where it's second offense with a deadly weapon for a crime against the person, I think that might be a way to go. Because the distinction, I think, shouldn't so much be between a felony and a misdemeanor as whether you injured or were threatening to injure another person.
Yeah. The example of someone shooting a stop sign is not what we're trying to reach.
So...
It
wouldn't be too difficult to craft this in a format where if they had a prior offense with a deadly weapon in a crime against a person, then they would be waived for the second set of offense. That's what the committee wants to do. I think that would be a reasonable position to take.
We have, I noticed Dean Guinelli has joined us, maybe reluctantly, maybe not. Have you come on behalf of the Department of Law with regard to Senate Bill 26?
Yes.
Could you join us and state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Let me just tell you what the discussion so far has gone through. The original bill dealing with... basically all crimes involving a firearm. The question is, and I raised the question of adding or deadly weapon. The other considerations have been applying it only to felonies or applying it only to crimes against a person. So those are kind of the things that we have been talking about back and forth as we discussed the legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I had understood that the committee was interested in hearing testimony about when and under what circumstances force can be used in self-defense. If the question is expanding this bill to have additional juveniles waived to adult jurisdiction, I'm not certain that I can speak on behalf of either the department or the administration. I think that these are largely policy questions, and if that's the specific committee's question, I can go back and find out what our position is. But I understood the committee's question was something else when I came over here.
There are also a number of technical questions that you can help us with. The position given to us by Health and Social Services was opposition to the bill from the administration. Assuming that, we are still interested in the Department of Law's expertise in terms of what works, what doesn't work, and what within the policy discussion, you know, you can help us with in terms of how it applies. I think there is a legislative interest in expanding the list of automatic waivers to those over 14 involved in crimes with firearms or deadly weapons or a combination of the two.
Mr. Chairman, I think from a prosecution standpoint, probably what's the more flexibility that we have as prosecutors to resolve a case one way or another, probably the better from our standpoint. In other words, if we can, by having additional penalties or additional options available under the law, send a particular juvenile in one direction or another, I think that we prefer to have that level of discretion. However, it then becomes a question of what is best for for that juvenile, for that particular case, and that becomes largely a question of what kind of resources does the Department of Health and Social Services have to treat any particular individual? What kind of resources would the Department of Corrections have to treat that individual if they are handled as an adult? And I think that those kinds of resource allocation questions are things that you really need to hear from the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services on. I mean, I think it creates difficulties for the Department of Corrections to deal with young offenders. I mean, they don't have the kind of flexibility within the correctional system to create, separate units for young offenders. It's one thing to deal with a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old who has committed a murder. They have over the years dealt with a number of those kinds of individuals. It's quite another matter to deal with a 15-year-old whose only crime is having firearms or handling firearms. I'm not sure exactly what specific offenses would be waivable. I mean, those kind of offenders, I think, would be very difficult for the Department of Corrections to handle. And
is there a status offense that is minor in possession of a firearm?
There is under 16 without parental permission is, some level of misdemeanor offense.
And Senator Donovan.
So Mr. Chairman, what happens, let's say a minor gets a status offense, they're 15 years old, they've got a gun, that's a status offense. First of all, they would never go to adult court for that, they'd never be waived. Then they do it again. So they're automatically waived to adult court, and it's still a misdemeanor. There's no mandatory jail time. There's no mandatory sanction at all, actually, in the statute, since it's a misdemeanor. I mean, the judge has got full discretion to deal with it. The only thing that's really occurred when the minor's committed that kind of infraction is that it's in the open, it's in public, and there's a record. And I guess my position is that if a minor is going to continue to violate firearms, it might be a good idea that we know that it's going on, that the public know that's happening, that they're a potential danger.
With regard to the waiver provisions in the statute we're amending and to the bill before us, are the waivers essentially mandatory, or can the Department of Law and the prosecutor's office really determine whether you're going to look for a waiver or not by the way you charge someone?
The latter is correct. I mean, however, if someone is charged with a certain offense, then the statute will dictate whether that person goes to juvenile court or to adult court. But prosecutors always have the discretion to charge a lower level of offense. I mean, that power exists right now with the current juvenile waiver law. I mean, if a juvenile commits a homicide, 16 or 17 year old commits a homicide, if we charge that person with murder, they go into adult court. If we charge them with a lower level of homicide offense, and it would presumably criminally negligent homicide would be one, they would go to juvenile court, and we have that discretion. And presumably that same discretion would remain under this bill. However, I think that with a lot of these more specific offenses, there are fewer lower level of offenses that can be charged. With homicides, you've got four different levels: first degree murder, second degree murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. Three of those go to adult court, one goes to juvenile court. With some of the other type of offenses, particularly some of the offenses that might involve firearms. There may be fewer lower level offenses that we could charge. I mean, I'd have to take a careful look at it and look at all the offenses. But generally, that power is always there for the prosecutor.
Assuming the administration's opposition to the bill as a baseline, if we were to amend the bill to include only felonies, for example, how do you feel that would affect the administration's position?
I think that
that moderate the position is.
I think there would certainly be a greater comfort level with it, but I can't. I mean, without consulting with the various departments involved, I wouldn't venture to say.
Well, okay, that's one option. The other option is crimes against a person. And the other question, again, as I said, is firearm or deadly weapon. So, but what I would like to see us do is something that makes sense from a law enforcement and prosecution point of view, and recognize that the administration, if they don't want to, doesn't have to use this tool, and will have all the influence of the corrections department and the health and social service department pushing on the decisions to use it or not use it, I guess.
Well, let me just say one thing in general. I think that some of this discussion is reminiscent of the discussion that we had last year with juvenile waiver. In other words, expanding it by making various changes, crimes against persons, firearms, not firearms. And I think that, you know, you can certainly craft a narrower or a broader law depending on any of those factors. I think what happens, though, within the executive branch is that, particularly with things like juvenile waiver, where a department like Health and Social Services, which feels that its juvenile facilities are already overcrowded and that its workload is already too high, it might very well view some of the people at the operational level may very well say that, well, if we can take a particular individual or a half dozen individuals and get them out of our responsibility and over to corrections, that's great for us. It may not necessarily be great for those particular individuals, and the Department of Corrections may very well feel, you know, we don't have the ability to handle them. And what you end up getting in some of these cases, I suspect, is a dispute between the two agencies, one agency wanting to lower its caseload, another agency saying, hey, we can't handle that. And so I think that it's fine to say that, you know, the executive branch ought to make those decisions, but in some instances those decisions are driven by resource considerations, perhaps as much as what's in the best interest for the public and for the individual. And so I think this raises difficult policy questions. And you know, I think, for example, with firearms as opposed to other deadly weapons, you know, when you talk about a deadly weapon, that includes knives. You know, you've got a lot of juveniles probably having knives, carrying knives concealed, probably carrying them to school. They may be doing that because they're fearful of what's going on at school. And I think you run into situations where you may be treating some of these individuals more harshly than you might want to. But again, I mean, these are difficult questions, and I'm not certain that I'm prepared to address them, having thought that I was coming over for a different question.
If you would, Senator Sharp, we have a question there, but if when we finish that question, if you would just stand by so that basically whatever we decide to do, we can use you as a resource to make sure that it fits within
absolutely
the operation of the law. Senator Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, if you listen to the discussion here, I think that probably we could ease the opposition from the administration on this and probably be more realistic if we would consider modifying the language, particularly on line 11, item 2, to say something along the line that would say the minor was at least 14 years of age, is charged with a crime against a person, is alleged to have used a deadly weapon in the commission of the crime, and was previously adjudicated as a delinquent on conviction as a adult in this or other jurisdictions as a result of a crime against a person involving a deadly weapon. Substituting deadly weapon wherever there's firearm and delineating the, where it says offense to crime against a person. And I don't care how uncomfortable the department or anyone else is with how they're going to handle this. The concern I have is the uncomfortableness of somebody confronted by a juvenile with a baseball bat and a firearm or a switchblade knife. That's what I'm considering. You know, that's my consideration. And how they handle it is up to them. But the fact is, we've had several instances in Fairbanks where three or four juveniles armed with baseball bats literally beat someone nearly to death, causing permanent damage to their eyesight and everything else. And you don't even know who in the hell they are. You know, I think it's about time that we made this information available, and that type of send a signal that type of action is not going to be condoned, especially if they've got one offense already.
We do have Janie Winiger on. Could you go ahead and give us your testimony? I assume you've heard some of the discussion.
I certainly have, Rick. Thank you very much, and Senators, thank you for bringing this bill up. And Senator Donnelly, thank you and Kelly for offering this this bill. It's on the right target. You'll notice in your packet that I did send in some testimony via fax. But our concern, being the NRA and Crime Strike, we've talked to these people, and their recommendations are that all crimes against a person should be covered in this: murder, rape, manslaughter, armed robbery, drive-by shooting, aggravated assault, leading organized crime, and arson of an occupied structure, and child abuse or molestation, that these be covered, and that the people that commit these crimes should be waived at 14 years old, and also that if they use any object as a weapon in the commission of this felony. You know, like I think it was Senator Sharp that said that, you know, baseball bats, knives, just anything can be a weapon. And it shouldn't be just firearms, you know. And I have talked to a lot of law enforcement in the course of my job, and they're supporting Crime Strike recommendations that it should be for any object used, and also for crimes against the person. So, pretty much that's my comment.
Questions by members of the committee. Thank you very much for your testimony. You're welcome to stay on for the rest of the consideration.
Thank you,
Senator Donnelly, I think I lean the same direction Senator Sharp does in terms of that combination of broadening the definition and narrowing the application. What is your desire to, how do you think we should handle it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to go along with that if that's the intent of the committee, to change it to apply to crimes against the person using a deadly weapon. And second offense for that, they should be automatically treated as adults. I just find that really difficult to argue against.
I absolutely agree.
No matter how uncomfortable.
And I think the question is not just a question of a potential veto, it's application. The administration does really control the application, and I think this is another tool that, particularly when you're limiting it to crimes against a person, really should be available, I think.
Yeah.
So if that's the desire of the committee, could we have an amendment? We could adopt it as a conceptual amendment and have it inserted in a finance CS in both of those places. If we have a motion to that effect.
I'd so move, Mr. Chairman.
We have a motion to change criminal offense to the proper terminology of crimes against a person, whatever that exact terminology is, and to change the word firearms to deadly weapon. Is there objection to that motion? Without objection, that motion carries. Is there further debate? Now, Elmer Lindstrom, you were signed up to testify and not here. We did have somebody from Health and Social Services. Do you want to testify?
That's not necessary.
Okay.
We did get the company line from the Department of Health and Social Services. What are the wishes of the committee with regard to the bill?
I move the committee substitute with individual recommendations.
We have a motion to pass out Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 26 with individual recommendations and the accompanying
all zero.
Fiscal notes, which are all zeros. Without objection, the motion carries. The bill's out of committee with individual recommendations. That brings us to, I think the fourth item was Senate Bill 54. We're trying to do the easier ones first until we get bogged down, and that seems to happen. We have before us Senate Bill 54, which is Senator Sharp's been carrying this legislation. Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I deal with this legislation that has passed through Labor and Commerce, State Affairs and Labor and Commerce, has matured to the level that deserves serious consideration. I have two proposed amendments for consideration by the committee that I'd like to offer on the Labor and Commerce CS. Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, the Labor and Commerce CS is the later CS?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Sharp, you have the floor.
Thank you. The first amendment I would offer and explain is amendment number one, would change the title to allow relating to employees of Alaska Public Utilities Commission, and with that add the on page one after line seven, allowing a partial exemption for two special assistants. This is something the APUC has wanted so that they can hire particularly qualified people without going through the state hiring procedure as such, I understand. I'm offering that as something they want, although I will point out that in my Finance Committee subcommittee, we eliminated the dollars for those two positions.
But this says they can, but they may not. Is that what
they
you're saying?
They can, but they can't this year. funds available, they
you're
won't
off,
be allowed.
Have you moved amendment number one?
Yes, I would move amendment number one.
We have a motion to adopt amendment number one. Are there objections? Without objection, amendment number one is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number two, which tries to get us out of the problem we've been into every time we get a new governor. And what this does would it relates to change the title and put in there relating to the terms of members of the APUC Commission. It would then go on to say that the terms of each commissioner will expire on February 1st after their sixth year, upon their sixth year, their six-year terms, and it would thereby allow a new governor to replace any positions or commissioners that if their terms expire by on February 1st, a new governor would already be in sworn in, be on the job for a month or so, and would then be able to select the commissioners of their choice, and we don't get immersed in this lame duck controversy, no matter who's elected governor. That's happened every time I've been down here for three governors. So I think it might be a way to defuse the situation and without future controversy. I would therefore move amendment number two.
Amendment number two has been moved. Is there objection to the adoption of amendment number two? Without objection, amendment number two has been adopted. Now what we're left with is the exclusive service areas for electric utilities only.
We're left with the exemption provision, except for refuse collection. We are left with...
That's it, except for the two amendments, I think.
Well, and there's a change to the... definitions section. Okay, we have, let's see, who do we have on this sheet? Do we have a sign-up sheet for this bill? I know that Dave Hutchins has been waiting. We have Bob Lohr online, too. Dave, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony? And then we'll go to Bob Lohr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. And I'm here in very strong support of the bill. It's sections 2 and 4 of the bill that we're particularly interested in. I think it must have been section 4 that the chairman was looking at then, trying to determine how to characterize it. That's really a conforming amendment in the statute to conform to section 2. Section 2 is the operative policy statement. The background to this, very briefly, Mr. Chairman, is that a number of years ago, we had a retail competition among the utilities, and it was a mess. We had utilities wherever they were adjoining, running lines up and down the same street. It was a horrible misallocation of resources, and in order to stop the border wars, that was why the commission was created in its present form. In Section 221, that this would amend. Of the PUC statute gave the commission a directive and instructions on how to do it, to separate the electric utility services into separate areas. And that job is essentially complete now, and now that it is essentially complete, there is some discussion that, well, maybe we ought to try retail wheeling or try some kind of retail competition. We've tried it. It did not work. The purpose for Section 2 and the conforming amendment in Section 4 is to give the commission clear direction that they're to keep the electric utility services separate. And we think it would very definitely not be in the public interest to return to the bad old days. Very simply, Mr. Chairman, that's our position on the bill. There's also the question of a fiscal note. We understand the commission had requested something on the order of $100,000 a year to keep from making changes. We think that's absurd, and ask that there be a zero fiscal note.
Questions by members of the committee? Would you explain the actual wording of Section 4 and how what it does?
No.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The language being struck out on lines 6 and 7 of page 2. That change is being proposed because that was a so-called compromise that was stuck into a bill that then Representative Donnelly had introduced back in the 80s. That this was intended to be a compromise between a fight going on at that time on the North Slope between a gas company and an electric company, and that fight is long since over. And the change here, the reason that it's necessary is that this language has been interpreted to mean that any new customer coming into a service area was up for grabs, and to be consistent with the Section 2 this language was proposed for deletion. The change that you see further down that page from starting on line 7. It had been pointed out to us that the language the drafter came up with back in the 80s when this was enacted was confusing because it had it used the same word for two different things. They used utility in two different senses in that same paragraph, as both the certificated utility and the other entity in the area selling some electric service within the limits. And so to avoid that, that confusion of terminology, it had been redrafted this way.
Senator Frank.
Thank you. Dave, was this bill introduced at your request?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The original legislation, actually we had requested that it be included in the APUC Sunset Extension Bill. Because this was a new issue that had not been in that bill last year, it was not added there. But Senator Kelly then introduced this as a separate bill.
Okay, then the Section 3, that's not part of your deal, is it, having to do with the garbage deregulation?
Sir, Mr. Chairman, that was not at our request. That was an amendment that was added, I think, in Labor and Commerce.
And you, I assume you're neutral on that issue?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We have no stake in that section.
Does that exemption section apply to electrical utilities?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does. And it's been used once on electric utilities, to my knowledge. Plinkett-Hyda Regional Electrical Authority didn't come neatly under the different categories for exemptions, and the commission used that 711D to exempt Plinkett-Hyda from economic regulation.
So there is a broad authority in the commission to exempt virtually anyone?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So long as they can determine that it's in the public interest that that exemption be made.
Senator Phillips?
Public interest definition, yes.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, that definition is not real clear. It's sort of whatever the majority of the commission thinks it is at any given moment, I think.
So, Mr. Chairman, then
Senator Frank,
am I correct to assume that they could exempt a electric utility or a gas utility or a water utility or a sewer utility from regulation, but they couldn't exempt a refuse collection utility? And we're making a special exception here for refuse collectors that seems on the face kind of silly. I know they want it, you know. I would too if I were in any business. But
can a municipal government regulate an electric utility or a telephone utility that's exempted under the PUC?
Mr. Chairman, no, they cannot.
But they can regulate a garbage utility that's exempted under the PUC, can they not?
I don't know garbage law that well. I couldn't really respond.
We know garbage law real well.
There's only a few specialists in the state.
It's always been my question with the deregulation of garbage, which I would generally support, is that in some ways you deregulate something and municipal regulation comes right back in behind you, and it's allowed in that area where it isn't in the other areas. And it can, in fact, take away, you know, a service area. I mean, if we were truly going to deregulate that area, which I don't have any problem with doing, then I'd want to make sure we had an exemption from municipal regulation as well. Because otherwise, what you get is, a battle at the local level, and it may be used to take over a company because the municipality may want to provide the service on a government level. And that's why I worry. Senator Frank,
we should understand this a little bit more. I have concerns. I'd like to have the opportunity to offer an amendment to take Section 3 out. I think status quo, frankly, you know, even if you're an ardent free marketer like I am, there's not much danger that they're going to go out there and deregulate garbage in the short run. They haven't done it for the last 30 years, so I don't know that there's much danger that they're going to go out there and do something unusual. I just don't feel that extra exemption here, it would be in order. I think it's frankly inappropriate, and I'd like to have the opportunity to offer an amendment to take that section out.
Well, we have the
Do we have any further questions for Mr. Hutchins? He apparently is not a specialist in garbage law. Senator Rieger.
If we're going back to electricity for the moment.
Senator Rieger on electricity.
I've read the news accounts about the provision of electric service from, I believe it's the refinery in Valdez, and how that might have an effect on the intertie. And I'm wondering if this would prohibit that, I believe it's a refinery, if that would prohibit that refinery from providing surplus electric power to the CVEA region.
Mr. Chairman, it would not. This deals only with the retail sales of electricity. And provision of wholesale service is protected under federal law. Competition is encouraged and protected under federal law. And under Alaska law, anyone has the right to serve themselves, to provide their own generation, their own electricity. And then under federal law, they have the right to sell their surplus to the utility in that area.
Okay, and that's what they're proposing to do, is sell the surplus to the utility under PURPA?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So this number, Section 2, to your knowledge, has no effect on the intertie evaluation?
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely correct.
Obviously an expert on electrical.
Yeah, just want to make sure. Okay.
Further questions on the electrical side? Okay, we have Bob Lohr on teleconference in Anchorage. Do you wish to offer testimony or just be available for questions?
Mr. Chairman, this is Don Schreier. Bob and I are together here. Yes, we have a little bit of testimony we'd like to offer.
Go ahead.
On behalf of the APUC, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on SB 54. The commission opposes this bill because it is contrary to the public interest and would take the state backwards. The Alaska Supreme Court has concluded that under current law, a certificate issued by the Alaska Public Utilities Commission does not confer an exclusive service area in a public utility. This is cited in Chugach Electric Association versus the City of Anchorage. This has been the law in Alaska for 28 years. This bill would overturn that decision for electric utilities. They already have de facto monopoly status because the APUC has not authorized more than one provider in a given area. This makes sense in the vast majority of cases. But conditions change and technology evolves. What if in the future competition makes sense to the legislature, benefits the customer, and is in the public interest? By the way, these decisions are best left to the legislature because inevitably they involve political as well as regulatory questions. How would exclusionary jurisdiction be reversed to allow the customer these benefits? It may very well require significant compensation to electric utilities for their loss of monopoly rights. To my knowledge, there has been no legal or economic analysis of this potentially massive transfer of wealth. However, if despite these concerns you do decide to move the bill, the Commission supports Senator Sharpe's two proposed amendments, for which, Senator Sharpe, I wish to thank you. We would ask also that you consider one other amendment, to create an exemption to the Procurement Act for Commission hiring of expert witnesses. The Commission recommends adding an exemption to the Procurement Act 36.30.850 to allow it to hire its expert witnesses for cases in a timely manner. A new subsection could be added to read, contracts for professional services or testimony related to proceedings before the APUC, including procurement pursuant to AS 4205-111B. This is modeled after an existing exemption provided to the Department of Law. The Commission has been unable to procure the professional service of expert witnesses in a timely fashion. The deadlines established in proceedings do not permit the procurement process to operate to produce a successful bidder in time for the contractor to properly prepare the case. After parties to the proceedings utilizing private sector procurement procedures are able to hire their expert witnesses on a timely basis, the Commission is not. Other parties, I should say. This either delays the processing of cases or forces the Commission witness to rush through the preparation of a case, thus affecting the accuracy and credibility of the work, as well as costing the state more for overtime. I want to apologize for my reading ability. I heard the Senate caller, and I was trying to read through this. One other comment I would like to make on Mr. Hutchins' testimony is Mr. Hutchins mentioned the drafting changes in AS 4205-993B. There are still some language problems per legal advice we receive with this section, and we'll be faxing down to the committee suggested changes in that section. We're open to any questions. Mr. Lohr and I are here.
Questions by members of the committee. Senator Sharpe.
Thank you. Don, Bert Sharp here. You know, we've discussed this before, and I've continually failed to understand why bureaucrats think they have the right to regulate. You know, the only purpose for regulation is because they got an exclusive monopoly territory. If you don't want to guarantee them a monopoly territory, we don't need regulators. And that's my stance and always has been. And what I hear you saying is you want the commission to be able, in their best judgment, to decide whether they want to fragment a service area where an existing utility has abided by the regulatory, has made substantial investment, and possibly open it up to cherry picking of large loads within that exclusive service area at the whim of the commission.
No, I don't believe that. That is the thought behind it at all, is that we would open it up to, to use your term, as a cherry picking. The basis for this is again, we're concerned about, you know, small pockets and not be able to serve our public the way we are charged to do.
Yeah, okay. The only situations I'm aware of have, you know, being away from the industry for 10 years now, but any place there was a pocket of customers that the certified utility wasn't able to serve, know of no instance when that wasn't released by that utility on a temporary basis or permanently to allow them people to form their own little community group or get service from some other area. You know, if you can show me any of those areas, I'd like to have you send me that information.
I'll let Bob Lohr make a comment on that, please.
Mr. Lohr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sharp, I believe the intent of Chairman Schreier's testimony was that he believes the decision ought to be made by the legislature, not by the commission, with respect to whether competition is appropriate. It would not be a bureaucrat's decision under that proposal. Rather, it would be a legislative decision, but does not believe that tying the hands of the legislature down the road in terms of a one-way track into exclusive territory defined and offered by law and therefore very difficult to ever reverse, if it is appropriate to reverse it in the future.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that's what this bill does.
See, apparently we are going to have some faxed information coming back to us. Senator Frank also is interested in amending this bill, and our bells have rung, so we should be down in session. We're going to come back at 2:30. The first bill we will take up is 151, Administrative Director of the Court System, and then we will go to Judicial Review, Teacher Tenure, and see if we can pick up any more non-controversial bills along the way down our list.
You can take that thing out. Exactly. I don't know if you got mine.
Coming back at 2:30.
I got to look at it.
Vote the budget then, after the bills? Or?
The budget discussion, I think, will be at either 5 or 5:30, will it not, Senator Frank?
Yeah, 5:30.
Yeah. We are recessed for session.